Yeah, I was unproven in a lot of ways. I had never done something like this. I had not written a lot for major newspapers. I was cold calling people and being like, yeah, so I'm going to Afghanistan. I have some story ideas. Would you be interested? I mean, I did have someone literally tell me, like, don't go for us, but if you're going anyway, we can pay you $50 a story. $50. So this was not about money. This was about experience. This was about seeing war up close. And I will say I walked away from it being just amazed at what these people do.
Hi, I'm Bob Mathers, and welcome to The Growth Mixtape, a podcast where I talk to the most interesting people you might not have come across yet. I find that these conversations give me new insights and perspectives about topics I didn't know existed. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs in a mixtape, they create something memorable and emotional. Today we talk to Jessica Stone, a Washington-based news correspondent and author of Crossing the Divide, 20 Lessons to Help You Thrive in Cross-Cultural Environments. Jessica has reported for USA Today, The Washington Times, Fox News, CBS News, and the South China Morning Post. Jessica draws us in with her incredible stories, guiding us on how to better engage with our teams and our customers in an increasingly diverse world. Jessica shares tales of being embedded with the U.S. military in Afghanistan, covering Western issues for Chinese media, and the real differences between covering Obama's White House and Trump's. She also shares what she calls her epiphanetic moment with a stranger in an airport that changed her life. Please enjoy Jessica Stone. Welcome, Jessica Stone. I'm so excited to have you on the show. This is so amazing.
It's a pleasure. I'm excited to talk to the folks that are listening. Hi, everyone.
So I invited you onto this. I didn't really know what you'd, you know, whether you'd agree to do this. And so I was explaining this to one of my friends and I said, oh, you wouldn't believe it. I've got this person that I met and she's going to be on my podcast. And they're like, she's going to be on your podcast. Yeah. Yeah. And she's like a professional journalist. Yeah. Like she's a total rock star. And so she interviews people for a living. And I'm like, well, yeah. and you're going to be interviewing her. And I'm like, yeah, I guess so. And they're like, aren't you a little scared shitless of that? And I'm like, well, I wasn't. So, so I had a little bit of imposter syndrome flare up, but I feel, this is going to be a little bit more relaxed because you've been so amazing and you're just a lot of fun to talk to.
And we've discovered we're fellow introverts masking as extroverts. So we have that in common.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to crawling into my dark room after this. It's going to be great. Okay. I want to jump right in. I want to talk about the book, Crossing the Divide. It was really absolutely fascinating. What I liked most about it was the way that you laid out 20 really interesting stories, each with a lesson at the end. Now, when I say stories, I'm not talking about Thanksgiving dinner with crazy Uncle Lou. You're talking about in being embedded with the military in Afghanistan, being part of the White House Foreign Press Corps. Every one of them is better than any story I've ever told. So not only was it super interesting and fun, but I found myself really anticipating the lesson that came at the end of each one of them. With all these amazing experiences you've had, what is it about this cultural divide that you decided, of the 100 things I could write about, this is the thing that I'm going to take a shot at with my first book?
Well, this book is the product of a catharsis that happened during the pandemic after I left my job in Chinese media. And it was prompted not only by the time of the pandemic to write it, but also by a conversation I had in an airport lounge, which I write about in the book. And I know you love this word, so I'm going to use it. It was an epiphanetic moment.
That's it.
I think it was in O'Hare, where I had a conversation that just crystallized the last 7 or 8 years of my life of working inside a very multicultural, multidimensional, multiracial, multisexual orientation, you name it, we had it, but in the context of Chinese media. It was not in the context of a U.S. workplace. And so I needed someone else, I guess, to put a frame around it and why things worked the way they did, why some things never made sense, why it was so hard. And this person did that for me in you know, like a 10-minute, if that, conversation while I was stuffing my face before I needed to get on an airplane. So he crystallized the value system that I had been working under in a way that helped me understand that the value system I was working with was not the same value system I wanted to have, and I did personally have, and not a value system that I believe in as a journalist. And so I think I already knew at the point that I had that conversation that I was leaving. So it just reinforced that, but it also put a frame on a lens of those 7 years, but also all of the professional decisions I'd made in my entire life, which is that I seem to inherently choose cross-culturally diverse environments to work. And I'm naturally predisposed to that because of my upbringing, which we talk about in the book. And I'm naturally predisposed to that because of my curiosity. And I think in a way, it helped me explain to myself and now to others about those choices, which through any other through line wouldn't have been explainable, right? Like, why do you push your way into a French internship when you're in college and then never work in France? Why do you seek out a Chinese job when you have no experience in Chinese culture at that point? I was a Europhile. And the reason is because I was comfortable in that setting and I liked the challenges. But now I see the toolkit that I've developed as being one that is inherently necessary, if not crucial, for everybody in the working world, and particularly in the West, where yes, we're exposed to diversity, but we don't have conversations around the cultural aspects in the way that I think we need to. And so this is my contribution to having that conversation on the educational level, on the academic level, and inside corporate America.
Well, yeah. And I think maybe that's what struck me about the book and why I found it so engaging is that it's the way you draw the reader in with these incredible stories with an actual lesson at the end of it. I was as equally entertained as I was kind of informed. But I don't know whether you've had this happen before, because we met, I don't know, a couple months or so ago, right? And you came up and talked to me and you were very gracious and we struck up a conversation. And then I go and creep you.
People do
that.
Yeah,
of course they do.
I want people to creep me, but then I'm surprised when they do.
Anyway, I was looking at she's written a book, and I was looking at your kind of resume and experiences, and I don't know whether you've had this happen. It's like holy shit, like this is a force of nature, like this badass reporter that's been in all these places and just seemed like a perfectly normal person when I was talking to her. I don't know if you had that happen.
I don't meet too many normal people in Washington. And by the way, they're way bigger on the internet than they are in real life.
Well, yeah, maybe it happens the other way. So excited to meet this bigger than life person. And it's like, oh, wow, what a letdown.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'm actually glad I had the reverse effect. That's a rarity.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you talk about these experiences. So what are you hoping that people take away from the book?
I want people to know that they need this toolbox to be successful in a globalized world. I want them to think about what shapes their own assumptions about culture. And so I've actually written a curriculum, an online curriculum that goes with this book that is in grade schools, high schools, colleges. I speak to college students. You know, there is a whole cottage industry of this in corporate America, but it's approached differently than I'm approaching it, which is through storytelling, because I think at the essence of how we communicate cross-culturally is through storytelling. And yet we all tell stories differently and we derive different meanings from them. So I'm inherently a storyteller. I'm inherently curious and I love to travel. But I think it's also important that you see my mistakes, that you see that I've learned from some of them, not all of them, because if you see me in my day-to-day life, I'm certainly not perfect in executing all of these lessons on a day-to-day basis, although I do have a second passport, as I recommend everyone does if you travel a lot. And I think it's really in that vulnerability that you draw people in, because there is so much vulnerability in human interaction and in realizing that it's hard. It's hard to... It takes so much extra energy to communicate cross-culturally than it does inside your own culture. And so it's good to be prepared for that. I mean, I would come home when I first started working with the Chinese network exhausted. And some of it was because we were building something from the ground up, but some of it was because every conversation had so many more layers than it, than it would have if it weren't so cross-cultural. And making allowances for that, and then it really launched me on a sort of more academic journey looking at that. So I'll leave it there, but that I want people to have a taste of what they need to get, have a taste for why it's important, and begin their own journey to cross the divide.
Yeah. And the thing, one of the things that struck me too, Jessica, was I guess maybe my assumption when I started reading it was, oh, this is going to be really relevant for global companies. They got offices in 26 countries around the world. And so those cultural differences are kind of front and center. But then it occurred to me that one of the things that pandemic has done is really, you know, made the world a lot smaller in a lot of ways. And so you could be a company of five people, and there's a very good chance that you're not all in one place. Your people might be spread across two or three countries, even with a small company, which probably wasn't true 5 or 10 years ago. So it occurred to me that all the things you talk in the book, although I originally thought would apply to big companies, I can't think of a company of any size that couldn't, that wouldn't have to consider these things more closely.
Yeah. I mean, I have a slide in my slide deck for one of the presentations I do that shows, you know, you have one person in North America, you have the client in Africa, and you have the supplier in Asia. And we now have a system in which we can have a meeting of all three of those parties, and each one of them is going to communicate differently. And it's not just about communication. I think one thing that I really got out of that conversation with the man in the airport lounge is that there's a fundamentally different value proposition between the East and the West. And you have to consider that, particularly because so many of the suppliers we're dealing with are in communist countries with a dictatorship, with Confucianism as a value and with communism as a value. And that has a real impact on how you talk about truth. And as a journalist and as a person of faith, like absolute truth as a concept is sort of critical to who I am. And you don't even realize how important it is to define truth to yourself, really, and what it stands for until you go through these cross-cultural experiences where you realize, you know, I don't know if we're talking about the same thing, even though we're using the same words.
Can you talk to me a little bit more about what that term absolute truth means to you?
Sure. So it means something tangible. It means something unequivocal. It means that there are certain absolute truths that you and I might describe differently. So it allows for that. Like, I hate the phrase, sorry, folks that were listening, but I hate the phrase, you can have your own truth, because I think that's a cop out. I think truth is truth and it's knowable, it's discoverable. And yet, because we're human and because we're limited by our own humanity, we're never going to find all of it all at once. And so the ways in which we describe it are often different because we're, you know, you might find one piece of it, I'm going to find another piece. I think of truth as a diamond with many facets, and we may experience it differently, but it is, right? It is. And it's not what the emperor says. It's not what the president says. It's not what the prime minister says. It is. And there are absolute truths that we encounter in our lives that give us a sense of grounding. But this is a Western concept. Absolute truth is a Western concept. It's Judeo-Christian, Greco-Roman. That was the conversation of philosophy that I had with this person. I was like, oh my gosh, like I thought I've studied this stuff. Clearly, I have been operating in a fungible truth environment and trying to pursue an absolute truth as a journalist, because I think most journalists would say that that's what they're looking for, right? Whether they find it or not, but we're looking for it, right? That's like the main job of a journalist, is to find it and report about it and to hold those in power accountable in the process. If you're in the West and you're dealing with people and colleagues in other parts of the world that don't have that in common, you have to keep it as a baseline of how you operate, because they're not coming at it as the same way. And that's not a judgment on them. But it is a fundamental difference that has to be acknowledged and accounted for in the conversation and in the way you do business. Because as you and I think, started to talk about at the end of our last conversation, when you build a team, you need to have the same values or it's going to blow up in your face.
Yeah. And those values and, you know, that relationship with absolute truth, you mentioned that it's a Western concept, although one of the things we've certainly seen, and we don't have to go down this rabbit hole too far, but that we don't exactly have this figured out either, because one of the things that's making it increasingly hard to have conversations with people is that we don't agree on the truth.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to have a conversation with somebody that believes that the world is flat or that we didn't land on the moon.
Right.
And I know those are pretty marginalized. I'm not saying there's a huge population out there, but this notion of facts and truth is not nearly as black and white as it used to be. And we make assumptions all the time that, well, we all agree on these things. And sometimes you stumble your way into conversations like, whoa, oh yeah, we're not talking about the same thing.
Yeah. Glad you picked those two examples. Those are probably the safest possible examples.
Yeah, I'm not. That's why I say I'm not going anywhere near this, really.
There's a whole nother thing you could have chosen.
Anywho, so now you've alluded to a couple of these stories, and I do want to hit on a couple of them because they really stuck out with me. Can you tell me a little bit about your experience in Afghanistan? And you covered this in a couple of chapters in the book. Lesson 8 sticks out to me, but it's obviously a very...
Was that the, you need your face to do your job? Yes, it was.
Yes. Yeah, there you go. I think so.
Your face to do your job. My poor father, he is such a sweet man, but that is a phrase he will never live down. Because I had already decided to go and send myself there by the time he told me that. It's like, it's a little late now, Dad. Yes, I do need my face to do my job. Yeah, that was a caring way of saying, are you sure about this? That you're going to go by yourself? Yeah, it was pretty terrifying, but really, I think it's important in all of our lives to take risks and to measure our own, you know, measure your moxie against those risks. And this definitely did that. And it was not without cost. I don't write about the cost, but there were costs emotionally for years. But it was a great move professionally, and I'm not sorry that I did it. And the friends that I made were fantastic and are still friends today.
Can you talk to me, remind me a bit about what the context was, like what took you there?
Yeah, so I'm crazy, and I decided to go to Afghanistan in 2009. But I wasn't the only crazy person, so I take comfort in that. So this was 2009. This was before the national election. This was right after Obama took office and was doing a reassessment of the war effort there. And so it was a time when there weren't a lot of journalists in country, particularly TV, radio, multimedia journalists like myself. It was a good opportunity to break out of doing local and national journalism. And there was someone else in my life who was doing the same thing and went about 6 months before me. I told him it was crazy. Then I promptly decided to do it myself. And 6 months later, I went. But I did it in an even more risky fashion because I'm a lady, in case you didn't notice that. I'm a blonde white woman. I'm not Muslim. I don't know a lot about Islam culturally. I didn't at the time. And I have a Jewish last name. Awesome. Great. Let's go to the Middle East, where they're not always so fond of people with that heritage. So I spent those 6 months after talking to my crazy friend about him going, basically planning on how to send myself. I had to figure out the logistics of, you know, getting the protections and the training and the emergency first aid training, but also how do you embed yourself with the US military without a journalistic sponsor? And if you don't have one, how do you find one? And then how do you make sure that the work that you do is going to be taken? Because I was a stringer, which is the riskiest way to go.
Sorry, can you explain what a stringer is?
A stringer is someone that just goes places or is places and finds stories and sells those stories and then executes them. Yeah, I was unproven in a lot of ways. I had never done something like this. I had not written a lot for major newspapers. I was cold calling people and being like, yeah, so I'm going to Afghanistan. I have some story ideas. Would you be interested in anything while I'm in country? I'm going to be there for this number of weeks and months, and I'm going to be in this embed. And I mean, I did have someone literally tell me, like, don't go for us, but if you're going anyway, we can pay you $50 a story. $50. Okay, now that was radio, but you know that the most I ever made in an entire day was like $1,000. And I spent my own money to go. So this was not about money. This was about experience. This was about seeing war up close. And I will say I walked away from it from being just amazed at what these people do. Because up until then, I had a pretty low opinion of the military, having mostly covered screw-ups or dead bodies coming home. But to see them in action, wow. phenomenal group of people to make those kinds of sacrifices for something bigger than themselves, even and especially when they don't necessarily agree with the decisions above them. It's a pretty inhospitable place, but there are also gorgeous parts of Afghanistan, which is the cover of my book, is a picture taken by my fixer, who's the person that translated for me, that helped me get around logistically. Yeah, he took a cell phone picture and here it is.
Yeah, that I was going to ask you about that. That's, you know, insanely beautiful. I have virtually no experience with any of this. So I'm basically translating your experience into movies that I've seen. So, oh, the fixer sounds like this character in that, you know, in that movie, or, and she's doing these things and being embedded in the military looks like this. And
there was a movie about a different female journalist that was very similar. And I'm trying to remember the name of it, and I probably won't, but one of the Saturday Night Live actresses was the main character.
Oh.
Whiskey Tango Foxtrot? Yeah. WTF. See, the humor. There were a lot of those moments, actually, so that's apt.
Okay. All right. There you go. So another question I was going to ask you, so you actually, I think, alluded to this because you said you have two passports, which I didn't even know was a thing. Now, is this the story where you're running around trying to get your passport released from the Chinese embassy and you've got friends or colleagues that can't get through into the White House because they can't, didn't get clearance through the Secret Service? Like, I was reading that story and it reminded me of that scene from Goodfellas where he's like running around, he's like going to the airport to get the drugs, and then he's got to run over here and stir the spaghetti sauce, and then he's got to go pick up his friend and drive him to the airport. Like, it was chaos. Can you walk us through a little bit about what that was like?
Well, I had to write about that day right after. It was so visceral. Like, it was just in time production every step of the way, and I felt horrible because not only did I have my infant daughter with me, I was trying to meet up with friends from France that were coming in to visit and like show them the sights. And yet I was chasing this passport all over the place. I had been slated to go on one trip in one capacity that was not a journalistic capacity, but a tourism capacity to China, and then had to try to get my passport back from the Chinese embassy after leaving it there for that visa process to go for the Trump state visit, basically, in 2017. It was an exercise in perseverance that is probably, if I put it in a cultural context, it is a uniquely American sensibility where you just don't freaking give up. You don't, because you need that thing back so bad that I bawled like a baby by the time it finally happened. And I was not sure most of the day that it was going to happen. Oh yeah, that day had everything from like a major screaming fit by my daughter and a really nasty diaper and my friends not being able to get in to the White House for a tour, to I'm managing all of these logistics totally solo. And the people that I'm supposed to be able to rely on are completely in the dark. So I had to call like the National Security Council people that I deal with on an editorial basis and be like, listen, I want to go on this trip. You want me on this trip? We need to make this happen. You need to call the embassy. My own job that was Chinese wasn't interfacing those things. Like, so I was really on my own. I learned a lot about how things work, and it was like, literally I had to get somebody to pick up the phone and call somebody else and be like, take her passport out of the pile and be ready for her to come at this time to get it. And like, I literally made it 15 minutes before the embassy closed. I mean, you got to buy the book now, everybody, because,
oh yeah. Right?
But you know, your heart's in your chest the whole time. But it did feel like I was in a movie. So I think that's apt. Yeah. So the bottom line is, if you have a second passport, you won't have to chase the first one through the embassy to get it back if you want to take a different trip, and you have to tie it up in a visa. And that was the advice. The guy in the office, you know, it was like a security guard. He's like, so next time, just get another passport. I'm like, that's what people do that travel this much and have their passports tied up in embassies for a long time getting visas, you know?
Yeah, maybe that's just something that, yeah, get, like you said, people that travel a lot and have to apply for visas have figured out long ago. It's never occurred to me until I read that. It's like, oh, I guess, yeah, I could get a second passport. I guess maybe it hadn't occurred to you either until that security guard.
Wish it had.
Told you. Well, it's such a humanizing story too, because it's, you know, you've got these these stories of this badass journalist, you know, charging through these situations. And then I reading this, like, oh yeah, she's got like baby shit up to her elbows. She's got a freaking out kid. It's like, yeah, this is just actually a fairly normal person that just decides to do these insane things.
Well, thank you. At least we started with normal.
Okay. So we talked a bit about China, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about this because this is something, again, I was trying to unravel when I was reading the book. So you were in the US covering Western issues for Chinese media. Is that right?
Yep. Yep.
And what led you to that?
A phone call that led to another phone call. I was just looking for work. Like, this was not a premeditated move.
Okay.
Unlike some of my other colleagues, I had not always wanted to work on this basket of issues of the US-China relationship. So I sort of fell into it, did well enough for the first year on a contracted basis through another, through a subcontractor studio, that I got enough credibility to re-interview when they actually decided to put a physical bureau in DC, and stayed until I felt like a frog boiling.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? You were there for 7 years, is that right?
Yes.
And how had the job changed over those 7 years from maybe what drew you to it to what made you finally decide to leave?
Well, the work was always fantastic. It's a fantastic audience and a sense of getting to work on issues and stories that are very commercially related, very geopolitically related. So, you know, I really enjoyed covering the business relationships and the implications of U.S. policy on global commerce, which, of course, got very important in the Trump years in particular. But the relationship between the two countries soured, and I was essentially in the middle of that souring and didn't want to continue taking the arrows, and also did not feel like the cause, which began as a let's all help the world understand China, which is a valid enterprise. There was more and more pressure as time went on to shape that message in a way that wasn't truthful and honest. And I'm sure people inside the organization and out may disagree, but that was my sense. And I think you have to be true to that, particularly as a journalist, because if you don't have your credibility, you do not have a thing. And as we've seen all over the Western world, there's an explosion of crisis of confidence in the media writ large, and that has a lot of implications for our government. So I'm not perfect. I like to stress that. I loved the work. I still love the work. I'm doing the work now for a US outlet. It's just, this is the century of Asia. I mean, particularly China. And so understanding it, understanding how other countries react to it, the policies, the technology, the commercial implications, this is the problem set of this century, and it's going to affect every lane. I could probably find you a lane if we did like Jeopardy, in which almost every profession that you bring up, I can give you an intersection with something Chinese. It's just that ubiquitous. And that has implications, because now we're seeing a world in which whether you want to call it decoupling or de-risking, the Western world, Europe, Canada, Mexico, they're all trying to get some distance. And it's very hard because we've spent the last generation, you know, intertwining all of our interests in the interests of peace. And now we realize, oh, whoops, there are some implications for that that we did not foresee.
Yeah. And it's almost like certain people that are interested in wanting to appear like we've tried to pull away, but the reality is you can't put that genie back in the bottle. These, you know, just supply chains, for example, it would take you another 100 years to undo what it took us 100 years to do to get us here.
Yeah. But don't blame them for trying, because they're going to try, and that will open up their business opportunities too. So I think that is an interesting conversation to have. And that's part of the conversation I'm having now with my readers and viewers at Voice of America, is what are the implications of what we've realized and how we want to reposition politically, diplomatically, and commercially, given the increased caution that is now interjected in the relationship.
Yeah, interesting. I want to ask you, I got a couple questions, but first, before we leave this kind of era, in working for Chinese media, you were part of the White House Foreign Press Corps. Is that right?
Yes. You're saying core. Core is everybody that reports on the White House that has a hard, what's called a hard pass, which lets you in and out more easily. But the White House Correspondents Association is that represents all of the journalists to the White House from an editorial perspective, making sure that we have logistics access, that we have editorial access. When there is a major press conference, the White House Correspondents Association advocates for questions and to have things out in the open that maybe the White House would prefer or not. So there is literally a negotiation over everything the president does with everybody that comes to the White House, or they do together. And that negotiation takes place between the White House Press Office and the White House Correspondents Association. And so there's a lot of power in representing the White House Press Corps to the White House in the context of the positions at the WHCA. Within the WHCA, there is now a White House Foreign Press Group that represented the foreign journalists. That's what I write about in the book.
So you're not part of the press corps that's flying around on Air Force One with, again, see, I'm going back to my movie.
Yeah, no, you can be. Those negotiations of literally who's going to be on Air Force One is also part of the context of that exchange between the White House press office, because there are different ways, you know, we always have someone with the president because you never know what's going to happen to the president. So you have what's called a pool, which are the press that travel with the president on the planes, inside the motorcade. And then there are those of us who go unilaterally or go on charter. So my first experience covering Obama was when I was a radio pooler. You write the reports and you ostensibly have to send audio if there's like an announcement. And being inside the van that follows the people with the big guns, it's a little bit crazy. It felt very much like being in Afghanistan, except you're on the streets of DC. But they literally have like a vehicle where like the roof opens up and, you know, there's like a machine gun that can come out. Like it's crazy. And in the foreign press, we created our own pool system within the Correspondents Association where we would offer additional reporting about the foreign leader, about the context of the relationship, because generally speaking, your local hometown newspaper chain doesn't necessarily have the time to research the implications of the U.S.-Korea relationship before covering the two leaders meeting. And as you often see, and I know you see this in Canada as well, the questions are usually domestic when there could be much better questions to be asked on an international basis. Whatever's going on domestically, the domestic reporters will ask those questions. But often by positioning yourself against those as a foreign journalist, you can get the president to call on you because he knows that you will get a domestic hot seat. And so we leveraged that, even though there were a lot of foreign issues that were just as sticky.
Yeah, interesting. So you covered Obama and Trump. And I mean, I've got 1,000 questions, but just before we move on, I'm just curious, I've got all these sorts of biases and judgments about how different those things would be. What was that like, the difference between those two experiences?
As much as Donald Trump used the press as a foil, publicly criticized and called them out, there was more press access in that White House than in 8 years of Obama. He did not control his own people. So the leaking was like it was drinking from a fire hose, maybe a river. And people wanted to deal with the media. While he was saying we were the enemy, they also knew like we were the venue to get the word out about whatever he thought he was doing that was good, bad, or indifferent. And if there's anybody who understands that any press is good press, it's Donald Trump.
Right.
He has a knack for keeping himself in the cycle, no matter what the angle is. You know, you're going to be talking about him. It was the most exhausting period of my journalistic profession. I recently asked someone if they're ready for another 4 years, and he sort of looked at me and said, yeah, I guess I won't be sleeping again. But I think that's the singular thing, is it was a very buttoned up, much more hostile to the press environment in many ways, on sort of on the down low in the Obama administration.
Well, there you go. That's pretty much a stark contrast to what I would have imagined it would be light. I just got a couple of things I wanted to ask. So I'm reading this book and I'm reading about all this, these crazy adventures you're having. And then when we spoke a couple of weeks ago, you've got two young girls at home, you're working from home or you're commuting maybe an hour to the office. How do you reconcile those two lives? Is it just part of your life that you're left behind, or is there still something that's pulling you to some of that still?
Well, I still have the intellectual curiosity for sure. I do not feel like I need to go to a war zone again. I feel like if I stay in DC, there's a strong possibility that the conflict can come to me anyway. So that's not exactly reassuring, but it certainly will keep things interesting. I like who I am and know who I am in a way that I never did before I had kids. And they are now at the ages, they're 5 and 8, that they're really asking fascinating questions. And I love to learn fundamentally. And so I'm having I would say a blast, but let's face it, parenting is not an easy job. It's a job you never get rid of ever. And I'm aware of that because I still call my mom for help. And yet it's really rewarding to see them grow and become who they are destined to become. I'm glad I'm working from home. That gives me more flexibility to see them. And then I don't mind traveling as much because I'm not spending a day in an office. I'm able to be closer to their school to pick them up. And I'm doing much more writing than TV. We've gotten into a place in our media where I just feel like the best work that I will do is good written analysis and do TV analysis and be an authoritative at this point in my career, instead of just being the person in front of the burning building telling you it's burning. Like, I've been there, I've done that. There's a utility to that, but I want to tell you what it means. I want to tell you why it's happening. If I can hazard a guess, or if we have some evidence of why it's happening, I want to ask bigger questions, and I can do that in my current occupation.
Well, the last thing I was going to ask was, because I mean, maybe this is a tired question, but I swear I ask it as a parent of a couple of kids, although 18 and 21, so a little bit more advanced than you. You know, if you could go back and talk to your, you know, 20-year-old Jessica Stone after all the amazing experiences you've had, like, or maybe a 5 or 8-year-old Jessica Stone, I don't know. What do you think you would tell her?
You're gonna do everything you thought you were gonna do and more. And you are going to find that there is just as much adventure in staying as in going.
Wow, that's amazing. I love that.
Because when I do speak, part of what I want to really talk about as an example of taking risks is that I think for me, for a lot of people, taking the risk is going. For me, the risk was staying. I was so used to going. And when you finally find somebody you feel safe enough with to stay and you start creating a life, yeah, it feels really it's terrifying. But, you know, now the adventure just looks different. I feel like that was a huge gift that my parents gave me. It wasn't a gift because we had a lot of financial means. It was because when we had time together, we chose to use it exploring and discussing and wrestling with problems.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think there might be a second book in there somewhere.
You know, you're giving me a lot of encouragement. I needed that because I haven't gotten back to my speaking materials in a couple of months since our class. And when you're around a lot of people that have a lot of things to say that are already like organized, you're just like, I know I have something inside me to say, but I don't know if anybody's going to care. So if you care, like this podcast and give back others, the audience that he so well deserves for asking great questions of a person who's a professional interviewer and not quaking one bit. I didn't see you biting your fingernails at all.
No, not at all. Well, I mean, this is, yeah, you know, you've just been so amazing with your time. And you mentioned speaking, just one last thing. So what's next? And where can people learn more about Jessica Stone if they've been as interested as I have about this conversation?
So to my website, jessica-stone.com, and you can usually see what I'm tweeting about. You can definitely follow me on LinkedIn. That's where I post all of my latest articles and TV hits. I do regular TV hits for an Indian network and an Indonesian network, and you can see the work there. And I'm writing a lot about the intersection of US and China technologically and the unwinding that's happening. and the implications of that. So for people in business that are work have some kind of intersection or interest in that topic, I encourage you to follow me on social media. And please buy the book. It's on Amazon. It's at Barnes & Noble. It's in local bookstores. If they don't have it, you can request it. It's a good read, as Bob can tell you, but it's also a really good book to expose younger people to some of these ideas. I have people all over the world, China, India, all over the world that are buying it. And I think it's something that people at the beginning of their career can identify with. But clearly, Bob, I don't know that you're at the beginning and you found some things of utility there. So, you know, if you're interested in training or education along these lines, definitely hit me up looking for those opportunities and interested in speaking to groups about these concepts, because I really think we all can use a brush up, if not a thorough deep dive on these concepts.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for that, Jessica. And yeah, as I said, the book really stuck with me. I love the stories and you sort of tricked me into learning something. So that's always a fun way to learn.
Good.
All right. Thank you so much. You've been, again, so gracious with your time. This has been amazing, Jessica, and I look forward to many more conversations.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.